It was really coming to in a jail cell after being in a DUI accident. That's where it was like, my life is completely out of control. I have no control over my life. At that time, I was so helpless, sitting in that jail cell. I was so hopeless and just thinking like, I'm just a danger to others. I am the person that I hate. I am such a scumbag. I am so horrible that I don't deserve to live. But at that time, I didn't see the person that I would become. There is somebody that you're going to become that is waiting for you right now to make the right choice.
Hey, listen up. Are you ready to take your life and business to unimaginable new levels? Not just new levels, but unimaginable new levels. GoBundance is a community for active entrepreneurial men and women who desire to live epic lives. With the GoBundance membership, you'll gain access to high-level trainings, collaborate with high-level millionaire entrepreneurs, get accountability through our GoPods. My GoPod and I have been together for 4+ years. They're amazing, and experience epic adventures around the world. Plus, you get access to Go Wives, Go Couples, access to Fambundance, to continual high volume deal flow. Join this tribe. Trust me on this. There's a reason I pay my tuition every year, and succeed like you never have before. If you want the results you hear from members who are on this podcast, or even my own results, GoBundance is the pathway. It's as simple as applying and letting me or one of our ambassadors talk to you about what membership looks like at any level. GoBundance.com, apply, and we'll make sure we put you in the right community for you. Join us today. Back to the show.
What's going on, everybody? Welcome to the show. Today's guest, Adam Hill. You're going to love this guy. He's a 9-figure CEO, a world championship qualifying triathlete, a peak performance coach, best-selling author, international speaker, and a host of the Flow Over Fear podcast. I love that name, and it is really a great podcast. Also a GoBundance brother of mine. Adam, brother, welcome.
Dude, thanks for being here. This is a bucket list opportunity, man. I'm grateful to be here.
I appreciate it, man. This is great. Yeah. We got to jam on your podcast. We met up in Tahoe. So it's nice to, I love getting on episodes where I got to know the guy a little bit, because we can kind of start, I don't know, we can go all over the place. But real quick, world championship qualifying triathlete. Explain that phrase.
Yeah, so that's an important distinction. I'm not a world champion triathlete, and a lot of people make that confusion. I've simply qualified for the Ironman World Championship, which was a huge dream of mine. But that was, you know, I finished like 850th or whatever it is in that race. So I'm by no means like the like that. I wanted to explain that because you know, that's where I wanted to go with it. I just wanted to qualify for it. I didn't want to go and be pro or anything like that.
It's funny, like there's so many layers to this. So like, first of all, triathlete, that's fucking hard. Ironman triathlete, even harder. World championship level Ironman triathlete to qualify. You said the words, I simply qualified. I doubt any of that was simple.
No, it wasn't. And it was a big, I mean, part of my story, because I was never an athlete growing up. I sucked at baseball. I say that I was a bench warmer for a team in high school that went 0-10. I was terrible. I mean, I was just a terrible sports person. And then I grew up with an anxiety disorder, so that didn't really help matters much, because I was just always afraid of people and afraid of things, afraid of sports balls hitting me in the face and all that kind of stuff. So I just didn't, you know, I didn't really perform, or I didn't try anything. But after there's a lot of story in here, but you know, once I got into adulthood and in my 30s, and I realized that what I can truly accomplish, and that really came after about a year of sobriety. It was through sobriety really that I learned, hey, you know, I'm doing this thing that I never thought that I could do, which was get sober. I never thought that I could get sober. I thought alcohol was really like the cure for my anxiety, for my mental health, because it just melted everything away. And it worked for a while until it didn't work anymore. But, you know, obviously it caused a lot of problems in my life. And eventually, after getting sober and going through that process and realizing that there's really a framework for everything, I discovered that, you know, well, there's this thing that I want to do. It's called the Ironman triathlon, and I'm not an athlete, but I'm sure there's a framework for it. And so I just figured out the framework. And I obsessively focused on it, because that's my superpower, is obsessive focus when I'm really, really determined. And 4 years later, I qualified for the world championship.
All right. Let's go back to one quick question. 850 out of how many?
Probably like 2000 or 2500, something like that.
Yeah. Top 50%.
Yeah.
Top third, maybe even for that matter. So
yeah.
Such a humble man. I want to go back to this anxiety disorder, to your anxiety disorder. Do you have any sense of where that started, where that came from, when it started? Have you always felt that way?
So I grew up and it was kind of like this dormant worry. Like my parents or people around me would always call me a worry wart because that was the word for it. We didn't really talk about it back then. So there's no real big trauma that I can go back to.
I was going
to
ask you
really
that.
Started
yeah.
that. Yeah. yeah. That I feel was a contributing factor. It was just, I don't know if it was my nature or and there's probably a lot I can continue to unpack. I mean, I've been in therapy for 12 years over this, but really it was just generally this worry around, there was a social anxiety around it. And I think that it was exacerbated by the fact that, you know, because that was the case, I was also bullied. And, you know, then that helped. And it was just this vicious cycle that led to that continuing reinforcement of that anxiety. And it finally blew up in college. And this is a chicken or egg argument, but when you go to college, you know, you start to drink. You start to drink alcohol. There's no indication in my family history or genetic history that alcohol would be a problem for me. I don't have, you know, a father who's alcoholic or you know, people in my family that were alcoholics. But for me, I just realized at that time, it was like, once I had a drink of alcohol, that's almost when I discovered the anxiety disorder, because I realized that it was like, oh my gosh, this is the way it's like to live normally. I'm like social. I'm talking to people. I'm hooking up with girls. I'm actually living. And that was life for like the first year of drinking in college. And then a year later, panic attacks started setting in. So it stopped really working to that degree. And there was just something that continued to be broken. And I started getting these massive panic attacks, like where it was completely irrational. I mean, I would be studying for an exam and it would just like come into my head that I had cancer or something crazy. And I would like fall onto the floor, paralyzed in fear and just crying because I just felt that it was so real. And there was no reason to believe that, but it was just that's how it hit me. And so alcohol just then became this solution.
Numbing agent.
Yeah.
When did you first, had you ever expressed in childhood, or were you able to, these feelings of anxiety, or were they just something that was percolating under the surface? And I ask this honestly in the context of being a parent, you know, I wonder about my kids, like, where are they going to go? They're still young, but I, you know, I feel like I can see where I've done things that may be creating personalities or defense systems or whatever, maybe anxiety as when they were younger, like my own conditioning of what a parent is supposed to be that I'm learning so much about now. So for you, was it something that you recognized young? I mean, you recognize you have it, but that you were able to talk about, have conversations about, or was it always just sort of like this silent thing that no one really knew was happening?
Totally silent. Yeah. I mean, the only way that anybody would have known it was just because of my social awkwardness and how awkward I was. And so, you know, it's just kind of like a spazzy kid that, you know, I really liked to achieve things by doing things myself, like playing music and that kind of stuff. But you know, once I got into high school, I found my group of friends, you know, and I, you know, still have those friends today, but it was like, I found this little bubble that I could survive in where people accepted me. We were all kind of the nerds, the kind of, you know, that, and I started to, I guess, feel a little comfortable in that arena, but it would always show up in these ways of like, well, I don't want to ask this girl out because that's just super scary. And I fear the rejection so much that I'm just going to avoid it. And I avoided that throughout my entire high school life. And so that's really how it showed up. It was definitely under the surface. It didn't really blow up and I didn't really get diagnosed until I was in my 20s, when I started getting, you know, onto medication and stuff like that and started, working through it.
Wow. For kids now, parents, whatever, who may recognize this in their kids, is it I mean, would it have been helpful for somebody to say it's okay to talk about or to identify it even for you? Like, what's the solution for a parent who has a kid who might be anxious on some level?
Yeah, I think it's important to really normalize it and talk about it. Because yeah, back in the day, I mean, I remember just feeling an enormous amount of shame around it. Yeah. And you know, the idea that like I would actually be having these panic attacks, like that's not what a boy is going to do. You know, your boy's supposed to play sports and do all this kind of stuff. But yeah. I think it is important to normalize it, to talk about it, to realize that, you know, 20% of our population struggles with this, you know, and that's just anxiety. Wow. I mean, more than that, you know, depression. And everything else. And I'm convinced that it's actually becoming a bigger issue now because of the amount of stimulus that's coming in. I mean, human beings are not made for this amount of stimulus, like information from every direction. We're meant for sitting around a campfire, they're hearing a story and saying, there's food, I'm going to get it. That's it. You know, and really quickly, within hundreds of years, it's like, boom, stimulus. And it's overwhelming. And so that's at least my theory, is that, you know, that it's becoming more prevalent. And I think the good thing is we're starting to talk about it more. And I think the unfortunate thing is maybe that we're starting to go even farther in the other direction. And I fear that more people are leaning into it as a safety mechanism of being in a victim kind of mode.
Explain that. What do you mean by that?
So I think that, you know, that there's an element of having a thing, like whether it be alcoholism, anxiety, or anything like that, and it can be a crutch. Like you could say, well, I can't do this because of this. My thing is that I believe that we can shift that. So if we could learn to understand something like fear or anxiety or things like that, we can somehow shift them into a superpower. Or something that can help us, something that could be an advantage for us. For me, an anxiety, and I can't speak to other things, but I think it's just important to look at. For anxiety, it's like, okay, well, like I can look at it now and understanding that I have this thing that's always going to be a part of me, that's always going to be elevated. Well, I can look at it as like, well, that's also contributing to my amount of empathy that I might have for people or compassion or self-awareness. Yeah. And it's also contributing, it's also a signal. I mean, danger or fear is a signal that we are in danger. Yes. Like, yeah, we should probably avoid that bear that's coming towards us. But fear is also a signal that we're pushing up against our comfort zone, that like, you know, maybe just a little bit farther, we can experience growth. So I've learned in that process and kind of through the Ironman process, it was like, I was afraid of swimming in the open water. Like I was afraid of actually doing that sport because it seemed freaking crazy to me at the time. But when I started doing it, when I started just pushing a little bit beyond my comfort zone, I found that that comfort zone expanded, and to the point where now where my fear is not gone. I still experience a higher level of fear, but I experience it at a higher level of consciousness or a higher level of what I'm capable of doing. So that's kind of where it is. My baseline is a lot higher now.
Is it higher level of anxiety then? Like, is it more stress? I guess, is there an inverse relationship? It sounds like it, but I just want to kind of clarify that.
Yeah. Interestingly, no, it's about the same amount of stress or anxiety, actually a lot less because I've learned how to manage it with the tools that I have. And the fact that I'm not drinking doesn't contribute to wide swings of, you know, numbing and then, you know, crippling fear. So that's sure. Not there, but I understand that like the way that I experience fear or anxiety, generally speaking, it's like the butterflies in my stomach, the constant, you know, running of my mind and stuff like just jumbling in my mind and catastrophizing and all that kind of stuff, that it's not real, but it's still going to be there regardless of if I am just, you know, spending, if my life is consists of spending Saturdays with my, you know, going to kids sports and things like that, or running a multi-million dollar company, it's going to be there at the same level. That's just kind of the way it operates.
What triggers is it? Well, have you had anxiety attacks, panic attacks, anything like that recently? And if so, what triggers it now? Like what is there? Is there something you mentioned? It sort of like exists. It doesn't matter if you're running a multi-million dollar company, kids, all that. I get that. But is there something within there? Is there a trigger that you've noticed for you that's still something that you're struggling and managing?
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, I still do get them. I still get panic attacks from time to time, though not as frequently. I remember having one last year, as a matter of fact, and really it comes with just being completely overwhelmed, where I'm taking on too much, where I feel like I'm responsible for balancing too many plates. And that's just a reality of life, is that from time to time, we do take on too much. And we were having some struggles in our business. We were about to lose an entire region over a supply issue that was really, really weighing on us. And we were also facing a personal lawsuit for something really frivolous that was happening that we just learned about. And we had a family member, our daughter, who was struggling with a health issue. And all of those things just kind of weighing on led to a really, pretty massive panic attack that I hadn't had in a long time. And I realize now, at least now, knowing what they are, and knowing, that, hey, I can name this, it's a panic attack, I can at least acknowledge that, it's different than what it was when I had the first ones in college, where I didn't know what they were. I mean, I legitimately thought I had cancer, and it was like, it was just this boom, kind of thing. But now it's like, okay, I know what it is. This is a signal. I need to make some changes in my life that, like, I can bring this down. And I recognize, like, okay, I need to take a step back. I need to take that clarity break, or what have you. But I've renamed it from like something that is a bad thing to, it's just a signal telling me that I need to act on something.
Are the attacks the difference? Because, like, when you talk about this, man, I especially recently, I don't know what it is, but I have not slept well in the last couple of weeks. And I can't point to like one thing. Like, one night it's some sort of worry, like, I'm never going to make another dollar ever. Right. Like, I'm going to run out of money. And, you hear this thing I heard about, what the hell's his name? Ty Lopez. He has Radio Shack and Pier One, and that company's going bankrupt. And they, in the article, it said like they're burning money hand over fist. And in that moment, I felt like that's what was happening. Just, how like bills come, not even bills, but like these expenses all kind of come at the same time, like, oh, Airbnb to go away on this vacation, plus this, plus that. And it's like, well, yeah, I took a distribution recently, but I'm not sure when the next one will be. So that kept me up one night. Another night it was, am I creating anxiety in my kids? Like, am I doing that by wanting to take what they're saying as a negative and telling them, no, well, look at the positive side, and just not allowing them to freaking communicate what they're feeling right now. Right. Like, so bad dad, bad, whatever, bad entrepreneur. Like, oh, I need to do better with my employee. Like all these things, it's just random things. Are the attacks the difference between like diagnosed anxiety and, I don't want to call it like manageable, but like normal levels or what everybody experiences? Like, how do I know if I have high levels of anxiety or not?
Yeah, well, I think everybody has some levels of anxiety, and I think everybody has the capacity at some point to experience a high level of anxiety. Like, when you just put more stuff in, there's just more stuff to work around, and the alarm bells are going to start flaring and saying, hey, this is a lot. This is a lot of information in here, and this is your signal that you probably need to like think on some of this stuff. And again, I'm not a therapist or anything like that, so I don't try to diagnose where people.
No, but just like your, because you are diagnosed. You said you were diagnosed with it. So like, from your perspective, yeah, good question. Like, the question is asking like clinically, but I don't mean that. I mean, like, just from your perspective, what separates you from maybe what you you're in this world of understanding your own anxiety. So what separates you from, say, your wife or your kids or somebody that you look at like, all right, they're having anxious thoughts right now, but I don't see them as having my level of anxiety.
Right. Yeah. No, good question. I mean, I think from my perspective and what I can share is, if I could give an example of, say, somebody tells you that you need to that we need to meditate. We need to just sit quietly and just let the thoughts, don't connect ourselves to the thoughts, just let them go. That's kind of like, we just let the thoughts go through. For somebody like me, I have a very, very difficult time detaching from any thought that comes in my head. Wow. And when it attaches on, it just attaches on and stays in there. And then the next one comes in, that attaches in there, and that comes in there, and so on and so forth. So like, even say a conversation like this, where it's like, throughout the course of the day, It's like, well, yeah, it's a conversation I'm having with Jamie. I mean, I've had conversations with Jamie before. He's a great guy and I have nothing to worry about, but it's constantly, oh, what if I say something that's going to, you know, piss him off? What if this, you know, those kinds of things are just sitting in there, you know, and they wow. come through. So that's, I think the distinction is like, you know, where it's like sitting in quiet, these thoughts that come through, there's a lot of like, there's just a lot of activity. A lot of, as my CFO would say, a lot of feathers, but not a lot of chicken, you know, yeah. like just, yeah. Yeah.
So that makes sense. That's a great way of, that's a good visual. That makes a lot of sense. There's two questions I want to ask, but I'm trying to figure out the order in my head here, but let's go with this. You talked about tools that you use. I got to believe that tools are usable for anybody, no matter your level of anxiety. So what are the tools that you've found most effective in just day-to-day management of your anxiety?
Day-to-day management, no question, is breathing. I mean, breathing, okay. and this, I mean, everybody, I mean, not everybody, but people may like hear that and roll their eyes. It's like, oh yeah, hear breathing. I know. Yeah, whatever. But really, I mean, this is something we neglect, even though we hear it all the time, and you need to hear it again, because if you're feeling that anxiety, you're feeling that panic in the moment, that's the best tool you have in that moment. It's free. And all you have to do is breathe deep, and it just takes 10 deep breaths. So it really just takes breathing, starting into your belly, breathe in.
Nose or mouth, does it matter?
I personally don't think it matters, but I've okay. heard, you know, breathe in nose, breathe in, breathe out mouth. But I usually breathe in mouth. And I'm a big proponent of the Wim Hof method. I love it. I do it every single day. The breathing part is amazing. I can't speak scientifically to it, but what I will say is that it does wonders for my anxiety. I'm a morning anxiety person, so I wake up with anxiety. And that's another thing too, is knowing the time of day when you experience it is a big deal too. So I breathe in the morning, but in the moment, breathing, just taking deep breaths, meaning just breathing into your belly, letting it fill up your lungs, holding it for a few beats, and then just letting it go. And then as you let it go, relax these three things: relax your jaw, relax your shoulders, and relax your hands. Those tend to be the areas where we tend to start feeling the most tension throughout the day. And so if you can relax those three things, if you do 10 deep breaths, by breath five, you'll start to feel better.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Breath work, man. I've come around, not come around, but I've gotten more awareness of this recently. Even as recently as this weekend, this past weekend, my pod was here in the DR. They all came down. And one of the guys is he's all on the fitness side right now. That garden, he's crushing it. And he said his trainer doesn't have him count reps. He has him count breaths. Like, you know, do this for three deep breaths.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And like, that's crazy. I did it at the gym. I'm still counting the reps in my head, if I'm being honest. But when I'm like focused on the idea of breathing, the reps are actually easier. Yeah. It's like you know what I mean? Like what would be decent weight or something that I might be like, just get through it. I'm realizing it's not the weight, it's the boredom of counting. So the breathing relieves that, or not even the boredom, the anxiety around counting, I guess, like the breathing relieves that. So that's interesting.
Yeah. What about, that's
like, a, oh, go ahead. Oh,
no, that's a great point regarding the breathing while working out too. Cause that was something that I'd never done that with regard to like strength training, but with running, I love that philosophy because like, if you can pace your cadence by your breath, for every four steps, you take one breath in, one breath out. I would usually call that, if it's easy, it would be an easy pace, like then 3-1, then 2-1, but it really gets you focused on your breath too. And so you have that prompt, which is great.
Yeah. That's very cool. What other tools, anything else that, I mean, could be daily or just generally, I'm curious what else you use when feeling anxiety or when trying to relieve it.
Yeah. So I talked about my morning, my morning anxiety. So the big thing for me is my morning method or morning practice. And I know a lot of people here, you know, they follow, Miracle Morning stuff, yep. Hal Elrod. But, you know, I have kind of a variation of that. And I think that, you know, everybody's different. They can kind of attract their own things, but I basically try to bring every single morning three elements to my morning, which is presence, energy, and empowerment. And so you make that an acronym. It's my morning P. I know that's gross, but you know, that's what it is. But anyway, I the presence part is usually some form of like meditation or, and even though stuff is going through my brain, I still
that's
like, you
that's
know,
a book, that, by the way, that's
the morning
a book.
Pee? Yeah.
The Morning Pee. Oh my God. That's an amazing
I'm coming for you, Hal Elrod. That's
there
right.
You go. There you go. No, I'm sorry. Yeah. Continue.
No, absolutely. Presence is, really just kind of meditation or anything that you can bring your mind to the present now. And that's different for everybody. If you can't meditate, you can do different things like breathing exercises, things that will bring your mental state to the present. Energy, simple workouts. I mean, you know, again, Hal talks about this in his book, you know, just all it takes is like a 5-minute workout, like push-ups, something that brings you energy. And then, you know, the third piece is empowerment, like things like affirmations. I know a lot of people don't like affirmations, but here's the way I make affirmations stick for me. I make the language in those affirmations so powerful that they just evoke emotion in me. I make my body language when I say those so powerful that they bring that empowerment to me. And then I do a round in a cold shower. I don't just take a cold shower. I do a round of those affirmations in the cold shower. So I'm bringing all three elements, energy, empowerment, and presence to that activity. So that's kind of what I do. I make my that is non-negotiable. Every single morning I'll do that.
I love that. The Morning Pee. Yeah, I'm telling you, the book, I can see the blog, the whole nine, right? A new podcast, all you call it. But that's incredible, man. I love that. It's funny. The cold shower stuff, cold plunges, all of that. I guess I didn't quite fully understand the power of them other than you said it before, like expanding your comfort zone, right? Like I've been doing them and every morning I get in, just like 30 seconds to a minute, I just douse myself in cold water, freezing cold water. It's easier here. Don't get me wrong. You know, it's nice and hot outside and everything, but you know, I douse myself in cold water and it's not like, oh wow, I feel refreshed. I mean, I do, I feel like a lot, but it's more like I did it. Wow, I just did that, right? Like that's a way to do something hard to start the day and overcome that challenge. So that makes a lot of sense.
That's really it for me. I mean, I don't know about the science of it. I mean, I know, like, you know, there's guys in the group that know the science behind it. I just know that it's exactly right. Every single morning, I know that I'm not going to want to jump in the cold shower. My brain is going to tell me no. And that's my opportunity to say, brain, you're not in charge. I'm going to do this anyway. And then I'm going to go throughout it despite the fear. So really the only reason.
Is obsessiveness a coping mechanism or a superpower born out of anxiety for you?
Ooh, that's a really good question. I mean, maybe it's a little of both. I think that it is a coping mechanism. Thank you. So I think that is part of it. I mean, certainly when I was drinking that was a way, to cope. But I think that I feel like for me, it's part of my nature as well. Like just it's something that I have found in my life, whether it's good or bad, that I have an obsessive personality that it's going to be attached to something, that it's going to be attached to, you know, to alcohol, or it's going to be attached to smoking, or it's going to be attached to Ironman triathlon or growing a business. And so if that's the case, then I had better use it in a healthy way if I can, and better attach it to something healthy. And that's a practice, by the way. I mean, I fail at that still all the time. It's still, you know, a problem for me. I still get immersed in company stuff. I still get immersed in all this stuff. Like, you know, well, I'm having these problems in my W-2 and really these challenges here, and I can't seem to get through them, but I'm trying to force things in. So yeah, I still struggle with that. But again, awareness matters. And so if I can at least try to shift that when I become aware of it, I can live through it.
That makes sense. You mentioned earlier, and then I'll close the loop mostly on this. I might have one more question after this. You mentioned earlier on this particular topic, that is, about looking at anxiety as something that serves you as opposed to being a victim. Mm-hmm. What in your life are you grateful for today that you have, or a part of your life that you love so much that wouldn't be there but for the fact that you have anxiety?
Wow. I would say my experience with anxiety has allowed me to understand the challenges that my kids might be going through now, with, you know, what they might be feeling, with a lot more empathy, as far as, you know, understanding the fears that they might be experiencing either on below the surface or explicitly.
You can see it.
I can see it.
Feel it. Yeah. That empath in you. Yeah.
I can definitely feel it. And whether or not the empathic nature is a real thing, I certainly feel it. I mean, I sense the energy in the room. Yeah. It's, I definitely feel that. But with my kids specifically, it's just like, okay, I can understand what they're feeling, why they might be reacting this way. And hopefully I can shape the conversation in the right way, though. I also have to understand and realize that no matter what, you know, I think in some way or another, we're screwing up our kids.
Isn't that heavy though?
Yeah.
Doesn't that kill you? Like, fuck, man, that I know you said exactly the words that were coming into my head. Like, there's no way to avoid it.
Yeah.
And it kills me because I want to, I feel the same. I can feel in my kids, especially the older one, because not because of him being a certain person, but the younger one's 4. He's nuts. The older one is now in this age bracket where, you know, he's thinking and feeling, and you can see him building defense mechanisms around things that I know I probably have created. Like I said, be positive. Don't be so negative, like all that stuff. Right. But man, I want to fix it so badly. And every time I do, I feel like I create more trauma.
Right.
So it's like, yeah, it's hard though. How do you accept that? How do you accept that you're just creating trauma for your kids?
Man, so I've adopted this kind of new phrase lately that I've kind of, and I mean, going through recovery health, because that taught me the serenity prayer, you know, which is, you know, God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. And so what I've kind of taken that and flipped it in is really just take the reins and let go. So if you've ever like ridden a horse, I never liked riding horses necessarily. I mean, I haven't done it very often, but the first time I got on a horse, you know, I grabbed the reins and I immediately realized, okay, I have some aspect of control. I can move the reins in a certain direction the horse will go, but the horse is going to go whatever direction it wants to go. And so what I realized was, it's just like, okay, I have to trust this horse in some way and that it's going to go in the direction that, you know, I guide it or what have you, but I'm not going to have full control, but I have to take responsibility for all of it. Otherwise the horse won't trust me. And so it's ultimately, it's kind of like how I see that, because when we're dealing with our kids, of course, they're gonna be able to make their own decisions and they're going to respond to what we give them in certain ways, you know, whatever feedback or whatever, they're going to see that as guidance or trauma or whatever it may be. And we're going, if we internalize that, that really becomes our problem. But I think the best that we can do is really just take the reins, give them the guidance they can, and you know, hope that they can trust us on that and understand that, you know, ultimately, while we're responsible for all of it, there should be no shame, no blame in anything as long as we are doing our best. And I mean, I know you're committed to being a great father. Most of the guys in this group are committed to being a great, great, great fathers. And ultimately, you know, are we screwing up our kids in some way? I think maybe it's a little freeing for us to accept. Yeah. But, you know, it doesn't make it easier, but it's not an easy process. That's for sure.
I took you down a rabbit hole there. You were starting to talk about it. You were talking about how anxiety has served you. And I love the answer you gave, that the, you know, at least the first answer. And if there's more, I wanted to give you a space to give that. But just the fact that you can recognize in your kids what they're going through and have that empathy and that feeling. Is there anything else that you wanted to accentuate with that question of how anxiety has maybe served you, or how your relationship with anxiety has served you as a where you are today?
Yeah. I mean, I think that just by saying that, I look at the fear that I have as maybe a signal, and it's an uncomfortable signal, but it is a signal nonetheless that, you know, more often than not, I may be pushing up against something that I have to maybe push a little harder against. Like, you know, if there's a decision at work that I'm having fear over, well, you know, is it going to help me grow by going beyond that fear or you know, what have you? So there's an element of fear as a signal that you have an opportunity to grow, if I can look at it that way. So that's one of the ways that I try to look at it.
No, it makes sense. At what point did you accept that you had a problem with alcohol? When did you actually acknowledge that you were an alcoholic, and why?
I mean, I think acknowledgement and acceptance were really, really different times.
Interesting. I mean, oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Because I pretty much knew that I had a problem back in college. I mean, when I started to black out and really just like, you know, lose time. And that's one of those things where it was like, well, once I realized that alcohol wasn't working for me anymore and that it became a problem, now I was a full-blown alcoholic, and it wasn't just an easy fix of like stopping drinking. Now it's like, now it's part of me. And so I realized, like in college when I was blacking out, it was like I would drink to, you know, to and feel good, and then black out, and then I would come to and have this crippling anxiety and, you know, and the crippling fear, and then it would be just like white knuckling it through the day to wait until I could drink again. And so that's kind of when it became acknowledged, okay, I have a problem. Now the question is, how do I live with this, and how do I manage it? Cause it's the only thing working to keep me, you know, to keep me what I would call sane, so to speak. And so that's where it became like, all right, I'm going to set rules for myself. All right. I'm not going to drink before 5 PM. I'm not going to drink on weeknights. I'm not going to drink hard alcohol. I'm going to stick to wine and beer. So setting those rules for myself, it was like I was an alcoholic gremlin, you know, like don't drink before midnight. But yeah, it was that's kind of how that went. And one of the last rules that I broke for myself was never drink and drive, which that was like the non-negotiable. I mean, because I had such hatred towards people who did that, like putting people's lives at risk. And then, you know, so it was really coming to in a jail cell after being in a DUI accident that made me, you know, that's where it was like, my life is completely out of control. I have no control over my life, and I either need to end it or I need to get help. Like I need to get help and be in it. And that's where, you know, I made the very fortunate decision. And this is a big one, because at that time I was so helpless sitting in that jail. So I was so hopeless and just thinking like, I'm just a danger to others. I'm the person that I hate. I am such a scumbag. I am so horrible that I don't deserve to live. But at that time, I didn't see the person that I would become. And that's, you know, that's the message I want to be able to convey to everybody who's feeling that sense of hopelessness, is that there is somebody that you're going to become that is waiting for you right now to make the right choice. And I thank God every day that I made the choice to lean into help and not end my life, because I mean, the miracles that have happened, even living with anxiety, especially living with anxiety beyond that, every day has been a blessing since then, because I chose to, you know, walk out of there and walk into treatment and start to heal.
Wow. Was there anybody, were you injured? Anybody injured in that accident?
No, thankfully, no. I mean, that was just a grace moment. I mean, it just damage to the other vehicle, obviously, you know, trauma inflicted on my family for, you know, what I'd done, but thankfully nothing more than inconveniences on the other parties.
Was that your moment of getting sober? Like from that point forward?
That was, yeah, January 21st of 2012. And I haven't had a drink since.
No kidding. Have you been close?
I thankfully have not had a desire where I have been close to picking up a drink in that way. Man. I mean, I've thought of drinking. It's just by nature. It's just like, I think about it. But if I'm being honest with you, like right now, I'll still have nightmares about drinking. That's like, I'm thankful that they're nightmares.
Yeah.
And I'm thankful that they're not, you know, dreams like desires or fantasies. They're still nightmares.
Wow, man. So powerful, incredible. So tell me a little bit more about, we took a lot of time on that. That's on me because it was just an amazing story. I appreciate you sharing so much. I'm looking at my notes to make sure I didn't miss anything I really wanted to dive into. And I think I got everything. Oh, actually, no, I wanted to ask you this. You talked about frameworks. You determined that there are frameworks for everything. And you've used that for triathlons. Explain that. When did you discover frameworks and how does that show up in your life?
Yeah. So frameworks showed up for me when I got into treatment. I mean, that's the first thing you see is there's 12 steps. Here's 12 steps to get sober and stay sober. And it was like, okay. So I'd seen that before. I mean, like when I'd been an alcoholic and I've like dabbled in AA and all this kind of stuff. And I was like, yeah, okay. That's the thing. But then I realized and within that framework and working through that framework, that it's like, okay, here are the steps to actually get and stay sober. And what I found is that they worked when I worked them with people. And that's the other powerful element. And this is what you shared on my show. And what I have heard so many times by interviewing people like yourself and others is that community is such a huge value in whether it's a healing or a growing kind of prospect. So community was a very important part of that. But the framework was just, you know, that was the 12 steps. And I learned, you know, through that, it's like, hey, there's a framework for that. I wonder if there's a framework for, you know, triathlon. And then I realized working with a coach, I worked with Mark Allen coaching when I first started in triathlon. And I realized that there's this framework for this too. There's what they call a macro cycle where you start with a base building phase, where you start to build a base by, you know, building your endurance over this time. So I can start at zero and build up to, you know, a 1 hour run and then a 1.5 hour run and then a 2 hour run and so on through this process. And then you build on your peak phase where you start incorporating speed and then you taper. And so that's where I kind of came to realize, okay, now there's a framework for this. As long as you follow it with consistency and that you're all in, you know, you can really advance and you know, my theory is that for really a lot of things, there's probably a framework behind it that you can adopt in order to get from point A to point B. As long as you're disciplined, as long as you follow it, as long as you lean into a community to help and support through it.
Blow Over Fear is your podcast, and we'll talk about that at the end of the show. I'm nowhere near wrapped up here because I have so many questions. I could spend 2 hours with you, to be honest with you. But Flow Over Fear, what I'm wondering is, are frameworks part and parcel of creating flow?
I think so. I mean, in fact, one of the people I follow on flow is that in the moment, you know, of trying to achieve flow, Stephen Kotler, I think his name, he wrote the book called The Art of Impossible.
I've heard of the book.
Yeah, it's a great, great, great book. He has something about fear in there, or flow, I'm sorry. And he talks about in the moment how we can achieve flow. And there really is kind of this framework where it's like, okay, you just start by doing the activity, right? Like if you want to write a book or you want to write a chapter of a book, you just start writing the chapter for, you know, 20 minutes or whatever it is. And then after that 20 minutes, you're probably going to kind of grind through it and struggle through it. But then you take a break and you go walk around for 20 minutes, you get out of that place and then you come back to it and then you get into it. And then you start to get into this flow state. It may not work every time, but you start to get into that flow state and then, you know, you'll grow in productivity and you'll feel that, like that in the zone kind of moment. And then that's you kind of getting into that plateau and starting to rise. When you're in that flow, you should do that for a while and you should figure out how much time it takes before you get it before that you could stay in that flow or that zone before it just drops off. Because that's that point where you just get to that point where it's like, you know, it just isn't working anymore. And it's not a gradual drop off. It's like a boom, you hit a cliff. Yeah. And a lot of times maybe that's a couple hours. So the key is to take that next rest when you're at your best. So if you can take a rest at your best, that's probably the best step to like picking it up when you come in next, because otherwise a lot of people just do it until they burn out and then they fall back into, like, they try to get back into it. They can't get back into it. Leads to frustration, leads to burnout. So that's kind of the framework that I like, is that if you can recognize where you're at your best, you know, perform for a while, then stop at your best, pick it up later after, you know, a period of rest or after the night or whatever, you can progress over time and keep going in that instance. But flow for me is really just, it's an alignment where it's this intersection between opportunity, passion, and time that we can actually take and run with. And so that's kind of how I've looked at it.
I like that. And you, man, I mean, think about what you manage day to day with the morning pee and all these frameworks and structures you have, the anxiety that you've had. You know, you're a father and a husband, you've got a W-2 job, you're a coach, you're a triathlete, you're a podcaster, right? You got all these things going on. You mentioned a moment ago about flow being, oh, I forget the word you just used. You just said it. It was in my head and it popped out, but maybe where passion aligns, something along those lines. Of all those roles, of all those titles or hats that you wear, where are you in flow and where are you pushing up against being in flow? Where are you in fear, maybe? Where are you in flow and what are you there just because of fear?
Yeah. So that's a great, great question. And I'm in flow where within my speaking career that I'm kind of building. And this is where I feel like, and maybe I theorize, and this might not be scientifically accurate, but I feel like it's easier to be in flow when you're first kind of starting and emerging in something, like, you know, where you're building it. And so I'm in that phase where I'm building, you know, the speaking career, and I'm starting to speak more. And so I feel like I'm in flow there. I'm delivering. I feel like I'm in the right spot. I'm feeling aligned with my values. I'm feeling aligned with everything, and everything's great. And then I'm also in this W-2 mode where I'm running my family's business. And, you know, right now we are going through challenges. There's a lot of challenges in a century old business, 100-year-old business that has a lot of family owners and a lot of things like that. And I'll say, you know, that's probably the area where I'm experiencing the most fear. And that fear is kind of grabbing me on, like, you know, I've got to make this work. I've got to make this, you know, for the benefit of my family, I've got to make this succeed. I've got to make this. So fear is really, really holding me there, like holding me in that place. And that's so that's kind of the big struggle I'm working with now.
What does it take for you to remove yourself from that situation? Or why haven't you?
It's a great livelihood for my family. It's sure. Obviously where my income comes from. And B, there's a legacy to it. There's, you know, family. I grew up in this business with my, you know, dad, you know, running it, and it's just been a part of the family for so long. And I think that there's a sense of obligation to it.
Yeah. Do you care, or do you think you should care about legacy?
I don't think it's healthy to care about organizational legacy necessarily. And maybe I'm wrong about that. Maybe I'm speaking out of school, but I'm thinking, I guess it depends on how you define legacy. I think it's very important that everybody adopt a set of core values, and that we live by those, that we have a set of ethics, and that we have that sort of integrity. But I guess legacy could probably be a double-edged sword, where if legacy is you being known for living out your core values and looking back on your life and saying, this has been an important thing for me lately, I don't know what it was, but right when I turned 43, I had this sense of mortality. That's like where it came in. Like before 42, I always felt like the youngest guy in the room. 43, it was like immediate mortality. So I have this sense of, like, what do I want to look back on my deathbed and smile about? Yeah. You know, what do I want to do? And that's, I think, the legacy that maybe is important. It's like, where are we aligned with our values? But legacy can be toxic, or legacy can be bad, maybe, if it's driving you against your core values, right?
So how is the day job and the, so here's how I'm unpacking that. I'm curious, and I don't mean to put you on the spot, but I am curious because I go through this myself, where it's like, what I heard, and I could be completely wrong, what I heard is I think it's important that you align your values with whatever you want your legacy to be in the context of the question of, do you or do you not care about true legacy within this family business? As far as like, are you staying for the legacy or are you really staying for the livelihood kind of thing?
Right.
So what are the values that you're exhibiting by holding on to legacy as a pillar of you being in the W-2?
Yeah, it's a good point. And thank you for putting clarity to my ramblings. I appreciate that.
No. I don't think that's what it was. I think it was honestly more like, let me dive the question down a little bit without it being a gotcha. The point here, I'm not trying to like coach you into why are you still at this job? But this is something I struggle with. It's like you said, going forward and seeing my life and then looking back and saying, okay, now I know what my values are truly. Like for me, I remember having this question posed to me. It's like, well, what do you see on your last day? I'm like, oh, my wife and kids. So then it's like, well, when do you align with that? When do you align with true presence and prioritization of your wife and kids? And for me, it's like, well, I got to do that now. Right. So for you, what I'm hearing is you've got this job, family business, it's a livelihood, and there's a legacy component, those two things. And I'm just wondering, if you flash forward to the last days, how much does the legacy of the family business play into your wanting to be there today versus just bridging you to wherever you're trying to get to?
I think that part plays in, at least the organization standpoint, plays in very little. It really comes down to, I don't want to look back on my life and say, man, I was a great employee for that organization. I'd rather look back on my life and say, man, I served people or served humanity in some powerful way that you know, maybe helped. And I served my family in some powerful way. Now, where that I guess comes into this is, you know, we are a family business. And so there is a family aspect to it. And so I think there's a lot of nuance in that part of it where it's like, yeah, I'm not tied to the values of an organization. And by the way, the values of the organization are great. You know, we do value service. We value, and I think that we're building a great company. And so I'm not diminishing that, but there's just a lot of challenges in running in terms of the role that I play as the leader. There's a lot of stress. There's a lot of obligation. There's a lot of like, you know, stuff that is challenging. So yeah, I think that it's a balance with that. I'm thinking through that. It's like, well, am I doing the things that I'm doing where I can be the most service to people that I believe I can be? And
I was curious. So pursuit of the speaking career, the podcast, all the stuff that you're doing, is are you seeing that as more aligned or like, are you seeing that aligned with like creating legacy for your family or being not obligated, but like being the best version of you for your family? So if you end up walking away and pursuing this path, is that the true alignment that you see, at least at this phase of your life, of you being the best version of yourself for your family?
I see that as being more authentic. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I see that as the real authentic person. And I know I've taken to heart a lot of what you've said and a lot of what you've put out, you know, as far as like, you know, living this authentic self versus, you know, where you might be going against that in some way. So I'm constantly trying to analyze that and look at how I can, and constantly looking at like, well, where's the authentic me? And is that authentic me? I mean, is it like, oh yeah, yeah. I mean, like, I think speaking is super authentic. And it's like, well, yeah, but I mean, I can, you know, throw a rock into a crowd of 100 people and definitely probably hit people that want to be a speaker for their lives. It's like, am I really fooling myself? You know, you have those imposter syndrome moments too. But on the other side, it's like, can I be authentic in my career and all of that? And so that's certainly an ongoing, I think it's an ongoing journey of trying to build that authenticity into the role I have as a leader. And if there's ever a point at which in my company where I don't feel like I can be authentic, like, well, yeah, I'm going to find a way to get out and be a person that I want to be. At this point, it's, you know, while we're going through a lot of changes in the company, I haven't experienced that point yet. I still feel like I'm contributing the value that I need to. Amazing. There. But
no, that's great, man. I appreciate you going down that line of questioning. I get curious about that with folks. I explore, like you said, that's part of the anxiety I have. I just always thinking about, is this right? Is this aligned? Or is it what I should do? Is this ego? Is it authenticity? What is this? Right. So I appreciate you going down that line with me. In the interest of time, let's do this. Fear Overflow. Tell me about the podcast, what you're looking to, who you're looking to serve, where people can find it. Give me a little bit more on what you're doing with the podcast and even your book.
Yeah, definitely. So I wrote the book 3 years ago and I just released the audio book. It's right here, Shifting Gears from Anxiety and Addiction to a Triathlon World Championship. No, and yeah, I basically wrote about my journey through anxiety disorder, alcoholism, and then working through the often humorous first stages of trying to become a triathlete. And so I you know, ultimately kind of led down the path of, you know, what I come to terms of, like, what the opposite, I believe, of fear is. And I have this theory that flow is really that opposite, because when we don't want to strive to be fearless. I think that's a dangerous thing. I mean, if you've ever been a part of a fraternity and you've seen the, you know, dumbest drunk guy in the room try and jump off of a roof into a pool, that's fearlessness. That's not, you know, that's not what we should be striving for. But I think that we should be able to dance with it, or, you know, and learn to accept it and look at it in a different way. And I think that's what flow is. I think we find flow when we find a good dance with fear. And so when we're able to rise above fear, that's what we do. And so I aim to interview, you know, people like yourselves who've achieved great things, whether it be in athletics or business or what have you, and not just talk about, hey, why are you awesome? Look at how all these great things you've done, but really let's talk about that challenging point, that those points in time where you face the biggest challenges and how you got through them, and really help people who might be struggling with that. Because it's great to see people who are succeeding, but I think the example that we can set is, you know, how can we help them through their darkest times and bring them out of that and show them that fear doesn't have to be an enemy. It could be an ally. We can, you know, make it our greatest ally.
No, and you're an inspiration, honestly. I mean, you've overcome so much, reading about you, getting to know you, learning about, even just today, learning more and more about, you know, the addictions you face, the anxiety you face, all of that, right? Like, it's incredible what you're, like, when I think about somebody with crippling anxiety to have a platform, get on stages. I mean, just that alone is unbelievably powerful to see. So honestly, it's inspiring to see what you're going through and what you're doing and how you're building what you're building. So real quick, before I go to the final question, I always have to ask guys, like, 2-3 quick benefits, or if there are none, tell me, of being a member of GoBundas. How has it been for you? And what are the big takeaways that you have being a member?
Oh, dude, it's amazing. I mean, I the benefits are 100%, you know, the relationships, authentic relationships. Yeah. That's been the biggest thing. Running a business as a younger guy, as you know, I took over my family's business at 38 years old, and it's an old school. It's a good old boy business. It's a chemical company, you know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So building relationships with other guys that, you know, might be in the same age as I am, that maybe playing a lot bigger than I am, made me think a lot bigger. And that's been huge in this business. I mean, it's helped us to grow our company from, you know, a mid 8-figure business to a 9-figure business at this point. So I think that's been great.
I love that.
Yeah. I learned so much from these, from the guys in this group, and I just, you know,
and I always tell that to people, like, you know, it's guru-less, right? Like, you can't help, if you're going to walk in a room of 800 guys virtually or literally, not to bond with some when they're aligned around being, like you said, the best business people they can be, the best father, the best husband, the best whatever, right? Like, just aspiring toward big things. So it's hard not to find kinship and, I don't know, a sense of relief in some ways that I can share ambition and I can share fears and vulnerabilities, because we're all going through the same stuff, you know.
Yeah.
Success be damned.
Yeah. I would have never started any of this without, you know, without the guys here. I mean, I really wouldn't have.
I love it.
It's incredible. Yeah.
All right. Let's get to the final question from the GoBundas card game. I like this question. Four clubs. What stands between you and more happiness?
Wow. What stands between me and more happiness? I really think that it's just the doorway from, you know, from inside to outside. If I can get out in nature, it's rare that I can get outside on a sunny day or into the woods or something like that and not be instantly happier? Mm. I mean, it's a simple answer, but that's simple. You know, often the simplest solutions are the
way grounding, man. Like even out here, the blue skies versus the gray, you know, honestly, yeah. It's a difference. That's not a simple answer. I think there's a lot of depth to that answer, to be honest with you. And I appreciate you sharing that. So Adam, how can people learn more about you? Is there a social media handle or just find the podcast? What's the best way to direct folks?
Yeah, man. I'm on all the socials. I have a website, www.adamcliffordhill.com. Yes, I had to use my middle name because
there's other Adam Hills in the world.
Tons of Adam Hills, unfortunately. And somebody's got a photography business. So yeah, but adamcliffordhill.com, which is my great middle name. And it's also my Instagram handle. And you can find me on YouTube at Adam C. Hill, which I like better. So that's
I love it, Matt. I love it. Thanks again for being on, brother. We'll catch up, I'm sure, soon. We got to talk more about speaking and some other stuff. We're running in a lot of parallels. So
yeah, man,
I appreciate you being so open today. Really, it was amazing.
Thanks, Jamie. My pleasure.